So I'm here today to introduce this session on archival collections assessment in action. And this is a topic that I am very excited about when I'm not trying to restart my computer. Put in all the passwords. So I want to start out with a couple of definitions, do a little bit of setup with you guys, and then talk about why this is an important topic and why it's one that I think that deserves your attention. Archival collections assessment is used to refer to the systematic, purposeful gathering of information about archival collections. It includes collection surveys of all kinds, including those undertaken for purposeful purposes of appraisal, setting, processing, and other priorities, conservation decision-making, and collection management. An accurate census of its archival collections enables institutions to act strategically in meeting user needs, allocating available resources, and securing additional funding. So why is collection assessment important? It's important because there is just too much to do and too many possible directions, and you need a tool that will help you to sort it out. And I need to show you my incredibly important PowerPoint presentation. Among these possible directions are cataloging and processing, particularly dealing with backlogs. See, there's too much to do. You're going to look like this if you try to do it all. There's too much to do and too many possible directions to go in. Cataloging and processing have been and are continue to be pressing needs. Dealing with backlogs is terribly important. Digitization is something that's relatively new, and we're trying to factor in how to digitize collections on top of everything else we do. Preservation continues to be a pressing need, as does collection management. So what to tackle is highly dependent on your local context and what might be important and where your priorities are shaped by both resources and opportunities. It's also worth remembering that we are in an era of assessment, that that our colleagues and our managers really want to have firm data on which we're basing our decisions and our procedures. So it's not really good enough to rely on instincts anymore. Your assertions about what are priorities in your institution really should be backed up with data, and collections assessment can help to give you that data. Collections assessment is really a Swiss Army knife, which can help you in your moments of professional need. So a lot of what we know about collections assessment is summed up in this publication published last year, right around the time of SAA, Taking Stock and Making Hay, Archival Collections Assessment. You can Google Taking Stock and Making Hay, and you will get to this publication. It's only 28 pages. You could read it during this session, but instead you can listen to us. What we want you to come away from with this session is that this is something that you can do. There are models, there are tools and techniques, there's a growing number of colleagues and a community of practice that you can take advantage of. And this doesn't require particularly special skills. And a range of institutions have used collection assessment for a range of activities, and some of those activities are represented by the panelists on this community. And there's, I know, more of you out there who are taking this on. I think that there are particular, one of the things that Martha and I reflected in the paper is that there are particular opportunity spaces also for collections assessment to be used in new areas, in areas where it hasn't been widely used before, assessing born digital collections. Ben will be talking a little bit about that. More collaborative uses, which will be highlighted in the presentation on the Black Metropolis project. Digitization, I think, is an area where we could really see a lot more institutions using collections assessment to highlight digitization needs. One of the things that I'd also like to highlight is that there are resources outside of your institution to help you with collections assessment. The NEH Humanities Collections and Reference Resources is offering funding in the grant cycle that has just passed, but I understand that this will be available in the future, and Joel is back there nodding his head. Go talk to him at the exhibit booth about this. They will support up to $40,000 in funding to support this type of activity. And I'm really happy to see agencies like NEH stepping up to help support this important activity. So collections assessment in action. Let's get to our panelists. I'm going to introduce each of our panelists in turn. They'll give their presentations, and we'll save all the questions for the end. So let's get to it. First up is Jennifer Waxman, who's an archivist and preservationista. She joined the Center for Jewish History as the Senior Manager for Preservation Access earlier this year. Previously, she worked at NYU, the Museum of Modern Art, and the American University in Cairo. One of the most important things that you should know about Jennifer is that she is from New Orleans, and this will come in as important information if you plan to attend next year's conference. She is full of information on where to go, where to eat, et cetera. After Jennifer, you'll hear from Ben Goldman, who is a digital records archivist at Penn State University, where he's involved with the digital curation and repository development. Previously, he was a digital archivist at the University of Wyoming. Ben went to library school at Syracuse University after finding himself burnt out and rudderless after 8 years of working in corporate IT. Lisa Callahan is currently the processing archivist for the Black Metropolis Research Consortium Color Curtain Processing Project, a real tongue twister, and was the lead surveyor and archivist for the BMRC survey from 2009 to 2011. She collaborates with staff at participating institutions to coordinate processing of around 150 collections related to African American history in Chicago. And you really have to keep your eye on Lisa because she previously held a school record for the district track and field for the 400 meters, which is both, if you know anything about track and field, 400 meters is both long and a sprint. So watch this one. And finally, we'll hear from Martha O'Hara Conaway, who's the Associate Director of Special Collections at the University of Michigan, where she is responsible for a wide range of operations and services. Martha previously worked for the Newberry Library and at the Yale University Library and the Library of Congress. She is the co-author of Taking Stock and Making Hay and the author of The Future of Subdivisions in the Library of Congress Subject Headings, which makes her an incredibly flexible person with a range of expertise and a delightful collaborator. So we'll get to the presentations as soon as I can find the next PowerPoint here. And that would be Lisa's. Oh, no, Jennifer's.
So thank you, Mary Lee, for pulling this panel together and for putting our mugshots up there. I realize you didn't ask for bios, and I now realize because you wanted to do your own research on all of us. So thank you. This is going to be a really instructive panel, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. So my talk is called Climb Every Mountain, Open Every Box, Condition Surveys and Strategic Preservation Planning. I'll be discussing the condition survey I implemented while I was working at NYU, and I'll first provide a little background on condition surveys, some context on why we performed one, and then I'll get into how we designed and implemented the survey and share some of our findings. If at any time you can't hear me or this is too loud, let me know, because I can't really hear what I'm saying myself. So NYU Libraries' 2008 to 2012 strategic plan mandated the streamlining of access to unique and specialized materials, and with this mandate, the head of preservation created the Archives Preservation Program in order to draw attention to the thousands of linear feet held on and off-site by the three archive repositories and special collections at Bopes Library. This new mandate signaled the strategic shift in preservation priorities of the department, and the head of preservation turned the preservation librarian position into a preservation archivist position, subsequently hiring me. The conservation lab started to incorporate more archival material into treatment workflow, and by changing from a 50-50 circulating collection, archival collection split to an 80-20 archives circulating collection split. Though conservators have been treating archival documents for years, the all-out shift to prioritize preservation of archives as an aggregate, not just as objects, was and still is significant at NYU today, and I believe it's significant in the field of archival management and preservation itself. So what comes next after you establish a preservation program and hire for it? For an archivist like me, my greatest preservation resource for understanding traditional approaches to preservation is Marilyn Rittenthaler's Preserving Archives and Manuscripts. So I asked myself, WWMLR, what would Marilyn Rittenthaler do? Marilyn Rittenthaler would perform a risk assessment of her repositories. She would design and implement condition survey of the collections, and she would design and implement policies and procedures based on the data. Data informs archivists and preservation administrators of macro needs facing collections, such as storage, cross-repository management, and micro needs of items housed within those collections, such as deterioration and treatments. Ultimately, data will inform management decisions about short and long-term preservation initiatives and build a stronger partnership between your preservation specialists or department and with the collection management units. It's a little precedent. In order to design the survey, I had to do quite a bit of research. Thankfully, the Columbia 2004 Mellon Survey, PACSCoL Survey Initiative, and Caliper all came before me. The difference between these surveys helped us decide on our approach, which was a box-level survey, a process collections that focused on condition recorded as both qualitative and quantitative data. The literature survey was easy because there's very little text that exists about surveying archival collections. I did find that Cheryl Gunselman's 2007 American Archivist article was very instructive. NEDCC Preservation 101 worksheets were very useful. The British Library National Preservation Office, which is now the Preservation Advisory Center, has a 2006 survey report called Knowing the Need, and that was inspirational. After learning about approaches to surveying, I evaluated the tools. The tools you can choose are worksheets, spreadsheets, and relational databases. The tools you choose really does depend on the scope of your project and the resources you have to implement it. A little bit about methodology. Again, it is our box-level survey focusing on condition using quantitative and qualitative data, generally following the PACSCoL methodology. Paramount to our survey was condition of housing and enclosures and the physical conditions of all formats. So we did not rate research value. We did not do depth of subject represented in the collection or any evaluation of arrangement and description. The only qualitative aspects we rated included condition of housing, condition of formats, and intellectual access. We kept intellectual access because condition is so closely tied to use, and it's easy for surveyors or new archivists or graduate students to rate it. This approach allowed us to achieve our main objective, which was to assess the state and rate the health of process collections held by each repository in order to do strategic preservation planning. This would not be a backlog or processing priority survey. So more on methodology, the survey tool. We chose the survey tool from 2004 Columbia Mellon Survey Project because it mimics well the traditional hierarchy of an archive, allowing for collection, unit, and material level data entry, and it's based on the PACSCoL methodology in and of itself. We hired the same archivist programmer, Jonathan Lill, who designed the Columbia tool and implemented that survey under the direction of Janet Gertz at Columbia. He tweaked it for us to accommodate process collections because it wasn't a backlog survey. So as mentioned, we kept the collection level housing rating. So these are the rating sections and condition rating sections. And then we added extra tabs for generic formats such as loose paper, photographs, still film. And we expanded the type of the drop-downs for sub-formats, loose paper being typed manuscript, newsprint, stuff like that. And then finally, we added a lot of checkboxes. This is how we'd quantify condition. We have condition quantified at the box and unit level, the box and folder level, and also for every format. And lastly, we decided to change the rating system from a 1-5 rating scale to a 1-4. It simplified that for our surveyors. So here's a little bit of what we did, of the type of information we gathered for each box. This is a blowout of the loose paper tab you can see on the bottom. This box is acidic. The folders are overstuffed. I don't know if you can see that from far away. And you can get the extent of, we know that there's loose paper and magnetic media. So this is a loose paper subform and the magnetic media subform. The loose paper is folded and has surface dirt, and we know that because we've checked those boxes. It was given a condition rating of 3 because it's stable and it can be handled without loss, but we know what its issues are. There's one, and then in this box, there's also 1 3¼-inch pneumatic tape with hub and winding issues and a damaged container. So it's given a rating 2 because it cannot be handled. Our ability to query the database by format or condition at all levels across repositories is astounding. This is the power of relational databases. When the survey was near completion, I sat in my office staring at this database, thinking up all of the possible and crazy ways I could present the data. It was paralyzing, but it's also powerful. You too can do this. So the survey tool is available at the NYU's Preservation Department website, as well as the survey manual. However, I did just try to download it, and the data entry screen is blank. So if you go there and you find the same problem, just carefully nudge the Paula DiStefano, head of preservation, there to get a better copy available. It's a very useful tool. So for implementation of this survey, we had part-time students who working in teams of two, opening every box. I hired graduate students in library and archives programs, plus one very astute undergraduate. I heavily indoctrinated them in preservation and surveying techniques by having to do lots of reading, shadowing veteran surveys for 2 to 4 weeks. I heard from every single surveyor that this was an eye-opening experience, one they would never get in an internship processing a collection or in class learning about preservation. Supplies you need, or unless you were in Martha's class. You'll learn that later. Supplies you need for this survey are laptops, Wi-Fi, pencils, paper, pH, pen, and a tape measure. And to begin, do a shelf check. We imported a lot of collection information from the Archivist Toolkit, but it wasn't always consistent, and not every repository used the location table. So it's important to do that in order to plan your workflow. Implementation. We did 971 collections, 5,501 containers. The lessons I learned was that you should supervise your survey staff. I supervised my survey staff, but I realized at some point that we had the condition ratings were being over, condition rating 3 was being overused. The condition rating is fallible. It was too easy for them to say, that looks okay, it's going to get a 3. Really, what we had to do was redefine condition rating 3, condition rating 2, and make sure they wrote in a note section the reason for giving the condition rating 2. That's how we were able to use our qualitative rating and make it actionable. Some information about what we found. In case you want more information about this, we can discuss it afterwards. 42% of our collections that were on-site, fully processed, that we got to, this is not all of them, are given a condition rating 3, which means that the housing is made of nationally accepted standard material, which does not pose imminent or immediate threat to the safety of the materials. But the housing of the collection may still have indicators of inadequacies, such as being inappropriately sized or overstuffed. But 58% received poor housing ratings, indicating that the enclosures no longer support the items and or threaten the safety of the material and or are not made of nationally accepted material. One of those conditions present required the collection to get a condition rating 2. The findings of the unit level, everyone's got it. Slumping and understuffing. So we found 1,700 boxes, over 1,700 boxes, 33% of our boxes were understuffed. Over 1,000 of them had slumping folders. Just for the fun of it, I cross-referenced all that information and found that we have over 1,000 boxes with understuffing and slumping folders. That could be a place where you target your first remediation project. In the end, we decided just to target all of them. But still, this is where you can get that kind of information if you want. We also found that we had a lot of mechanical damage with the kind of protective enclosures that we use. Your folders, when they get overstuffed, go below the line of the lip is too low. It can damage your material while it's in the box. And plastic clips warp everything they touch. A conservator once asked me, how can anything that's colored plastic be archival anyway? What happens now, the outcomes, remediation projects, we began by fixing the understuffing and slumping issue with an internal board support system and adding our custom-made cylinders, which is at this point discarded archival rolled folders. This is still a test project. We have to see if those board supports stay flat. But it really did when we trained students to cut them in the lab and to look at the boxes that they had processed possibly earlier or had never seen before because no one requests this material was raising the preservation consciousness in a way that they had not been trained before. Oh, one more thing, the really important, we found 30 instances of mold, 30 boxes with at least one instance of mold. So if you're trying to make a case to your administration about running a condition survey, mold isolation is a big one. You'll find a lot that you didn't know about. And we trained the archive staff to actually fit test it and did basic mold remediation as well. So again, raising preservation awareness. So the strategic plan, as we got around to it, became a focus on remediation projects and conservation treatments based on condition ratings and curatorial priority. The training and integration of all preservation actions into all phases of archival management, including accessioning and processing workflows. So this is kind of a strategic shift for the entire archival special collections, all repositories at the library, not just preservation. And then next step is to write preservation-focused grants armed with data. How am I doing? Good. Finally, we did do an electronic media survey, and Ben's going to cover all this. I saw his 2011 RBMS talk about this, and we just went full steam ahead. We didn't have time to tweak the database, so we just used a spreadsheet. It's available also at the NYU website, preservation department website. And we found almost everything that Ben's going to talk about, we also found and had problems with, so I'll let him take it over. Thank you. You can reach me here or talk to me later. That's all. Thanks.
All right. I see my role in these proceedings as attempting to demystify some of the issues surrounding born digital work. And one of the ways I think we can do that is by telling some familiar stories. And dealing with backlogs is a familiar story. We have a lot of backlogs, and I have to tell you we have another one to consider, and that is legacy media, just like you see up on the screen there. We have a lot of this material in our stacks. These are our born digital holdings, by and large. And we have to start dealing with them. The expression that Marilee and Martha used to title their report actually is much longer. It's taking stock and making hay while the sun shines. And while the sun shines is the part that really resonates with me because that's what implies urgency of the taking of stock and the making of hay. And legacy media does have urgency associated with it. It does not have a shelf life that we are used to with paper. I'll try to keep up with my slides. It's a little hard to try to match some of the things in the report with what I've been doing with Born Digital Holdings. It's still a very nascent field, and we're all trying to work out standards and everything, but I'm going to try to match it up. I really see quantitative assessment as dealing with this legacy media backlog. And it really refers in today to, when I speak to locating and documenting legacy media. It doesn't require anything technical, just to echo what Marilee was saying, only some time and effort and diligence. And the value of doing it is it can really help inform your future electronic records planning. Qualitative assessment, then, is, I think, geared more towards understanding what's on those disks. In my estimation, it does require a baseline program for managing the material. And it requires probably some kind of storage, but I don't find it to be overly technical either. My recommendations here aren't really prescriptive. I just want to expose you to some tools that can help work through some of those things. So let's look at quantitative assessment a little bit closer. For the methodology that Marilee and Martha proposed, they talked about answering these questions initially. And so will every box be opened? How will extent be measured? And how will content be identified and categorized? And I hope you don't have to open every box. It would be impractical to look in every box, but you'll have to open boxes known to contain digital media. And hopefully your collection's data will give you some clue as to where that, which boxes to look in. While you'll be counting every disk, the ultimate goal is really to come up with an estimate of bytes. The extent will be in bytes. And to get there, you'll be documenting the media type, most importantly, but also any label information on the disk, and also administrative info like the collection, the box and folder number, that sort of thing. So here's what the inventory, the result of all that work should look like. It's just a very simple inventory, as you can see, with the key piece of information being the type of disk. As I mentioned, nothing technical about doing this. However, there are challenges. Two main challenges in getting a complete inventory are, one, that we have not done a good job traditionally of noticing that digital media when it comes through accessioning. They're small sometimes. They can slip through the sensors. Second, if we do notice it, we haven't always had consistent methods for documenting it in our collections data. So those are two issues that I've faced in trying to track this stuff down. A third somewhat related issue is distinguishing sort of the fuzzy difference between born digital and audio-video holdings. So the two times I've done this, I've started by generating a report from the local archival management system. Here is an actual report from one of them, and I've highlighted a bunch of examples for you. The second row has the phrase, electronically generated charts, which is obviously a phrase no one would ever think to search for. The third and fourth rows have very specific descriptions of digital material, like homepage. There's even an URL further down. The last row lists computer card decks, which is a format I'd rather pretend does not exist. Hopefully, some of these examples illustrate the various ways this kind of material gets documented with your digital accessions. So I do have some recommendations for as you go about this search. I would recommend looking for variations on words like digital or electronic that can be notated in different ways, even digitized, since there's still some confusion about the difference between what is digitized and born digital. So digitized material might actually be born digital material. Watch for vague words or words like disc that can be written with various spellings. Same with CD and DVD. There are infinite number of ways to notate that in collections data. Look for very vague words or phrases like media or unusual ones like computer mediated, which is a phrase I'm working through now in my current institution. Even specific formats. So hopefully you get an idea that there are a variety of ways this stuff is documented, and you'll have to get a handle on how your institution has done that. So I mentioned AV holdings and born digital media. The main thing is I've seen CD used to notate everything from discrete files burned as data on a disk to commercially produced audio CDs. To digitize analog holdings. So it's not always clear from your collections data which of those situations is the case. You may not even be able to tell until you actually put that media in and try to play it. So having an inventory of digital media can be very useful for a variety of reasons. Once you know what kinds of disks you have, you know what hardware you need to read them. You can estimate the maximum extent of material found on those disks, which would be useful in determining storage requirements. Both of these can help inform the planning for an electronic records program, and having one of those enables the kind of qualitative assessment that I'm going to show you now, and that I think matches up more with some of the core archival work we're used to doing with analog material. So qualitative assessment of legacy media, or quantitative assessment, is really intended, in my opinion, trying to move you closer to dealing with those disks that are in boxes and identifying them and isolating them in some way. Assuming you implement some formal strategy for transferring the contents off that media into storage, which is another panel, there are a number of ways you can begin qualitative assessment of the material itself. So at the most basic level, we can assess the condition of born digital material by identifying and documenting file formats. So there are many freely available tools that can do this, that can really automate the process of characterizing files That is, determining file extensions, formats, the software used to create them, MIME types, and creation dates. This example is a software called Droid, and it's an application that can run through a set of files and produce structured metadata about those files, and you can export that data to a spreadsheet and then use the spreadsheet to do some further assessment. This screenshot is a sample inventory from a collection at the American Heritage Center, which was a very large hybrid congressional collection. Once you have that data in a spreadsheet, there's a lot you can do to manipulate it and interpret it. So this collection I mentioned contained over 200,000 files comprising roughly 100 gigabytes of data, and this tool helped me determine how many files of each format existed in the collection, and a very quick glance showed me that 85% of the collection was comprised of three formats, Microsoft Word, text files, and WordPad documents. So as an archivist, I might want to focus my time on trying to manage those as being the best use of my time in trying to manage this collection. There are tools that illustrate the directory structure of digital files accessioned. Here's an example of one that provides some very raw data about folders, the number of subfolders they contain, how many files those contain, and how large each of the directories is. Here's a more visual representation of another file structure. Both of these examples, I think, really illustrate ways in which we could use these tools to help understand the original order of the holdings that come to us. This example that I show you here is pretty clean, in my opinion, and as an archivist, I might not be inclined to decide that this needs much arrangement attention. However, this kind of assessment might also reveal original disorder, or what I like to think of as digital sprawl. This is one disk from that collection that contains 4 gigabytes of data, 1,600 folders, directory structures 12 to 15 levels deep, and over 14,000 files with hundreds of different files and folders named, for example, some variation of the word memo, and many examples of folders and files not named semantically at all. But this is an example, I think, of how using such tools for assessment can really help us work through these challenges. So a processing archivist I worked with, and I get to do my own shout out to Matt Francis, he started taking this spreadsheet data and marking it up with categories and identifying series and subseries locations for the various directories of files, and he used the arrangement of the analog side of the collection as his guide. It's probably evident that all these tools can also aid in description. File formats can tell us things. For instance, JPEG files are more than likely going to be photographic material. Directory and file names contain descriptive information that can help us gain intellectual control. But failing that, there are tools like this one that allow us to take a peek inside of files without opening them. And you obviously couldn't do this for every file in a rather large collection, but I think we're past that in the analog world anyway. Research value is not an aspect of qualitative assessment I feel especially qualified to speak on, but the one recommendation I think I would provide is to let what you know about the analog holdings or the analog side of the collection inform how you determine research value for the digital. In many cases, legacy media is present in collections that have already been processed, that may even demonstrate prior use. In a lot of cases, the material on disks is replicated somewhere else in the collection as paper copies. So all of this can help inform how you assess research value. And the Taking Stock report had an other field, which I'd like to use as my wild card, and suggest that you consider doing some assessment related to personally identifiable information. Archives have always had to deal with private information, but technology makes such information significantly easier to locate. Not only for researchers using the collection, but potentially for archivists managing it. And then having the ability to locate it also gives you the ability to mitigate it in advance. Tools like this one, which is freely accessible, can scan directories of files looking for strings of characters that match social security numbers, bank account numbers, etc. And it would be very easy to perform this kind of assessment as part of other appraisal activities we might pursue with Born Digital Material. So we had a time limit of 12 minutes, and I'm probably out of time. Thank you.
Hello, Hello, I'm Lisa Callahan. As Marilee introduced me, I work for the Black Metropolis Research Consortium, which everyone who works there refers to as the BMRC because that's too hard to say every day. From 2009 to 2011, I was the lead survey archivist for the survey project. And the focus of my presentation today is on the consortial approach to a subject-based assessment survey. And I'll talk about our experience working with a diverse group of participants. And I'd like to begin by giving a quick overview of the history of the BMRC to put the survey into context. In 2003, several groups of faculty at the University of Chicago were having difficulty accessing African-American material at institutions around the city. And to address the problem, the faculty arranged a series of discussions between the archivists and themselves to figure out what could be done. Through the discussions, it was decided that the best course of action would be for the institutions to work together to figure out the problem. And it was out of these conversations that the BMRC was founded by one of the faculty members at the University of Chicago. Today, the BMRC is an unincorporated association of libraries, universities, and other archival institutions in Chicago, and its mission is to make broadly accessible its members' holdings that document African American and African diasporic history, culture, and politics in Chicago. One of the many innovations as a result of the collaborative effort was the survey project. And in December 2008, the BMRC received a grant from the Mellon Foundation to implement the survey project of archival collections related to African American history in Chicago. And while there are other assessments and survey projects that precede the BMRC's, such as PACSCoL, which we're modeled after, ours is unique in that it was subject-based, included community-based centers and record creators, and also included archival workshops open to participants and community members. The goals of the project were to assess African American primary resource material, inform the prioritization and preservation needs related to access, and create preliminary descriptions of collections that were inaccessible to researchers. In turn, by increasing knowledge of Chicago's archival collections, participants could develop grant proposals individually or collaboratively through the consortium that address access and preservation needs. In addition to provide data for internal analysis, the collection-level descriptions created would be made available to researchers on the BMRC survey website. The project director, Burgess Jules, and I were hired in the summer of 2009. And it should be noted here that this was both of our first professional positions outside of school. So we made a lot of mistakes and we learned a lot. And I'd like to share with you how some of the challenges that we faced shaped our retroactive planning phase. And though it may seem obvious to you as it does to us now in hindsight, I hope it will be helpful to those of you planning a multi-institutional project. As I mentioned, the BMRC was based on the PACSCoL survey initiative. We recruited their survey staff to lead a two-day training workshop in Chicago where they trained us on survey techniques, the use of their database, and shared their documentation. And although we tweaked their project documentation to fit the goals and scope of our project, their willingness to share allowed our project to start with a much stronger foundation and one that we always mention that we're happy to reciprocate on. Okay, and this seems like a fairly straightforward step, but when you're working with a number of archivists and non-archivists in a wide variety of institutions across the city, it's absolutely necessary to spend the time preparing your project documentation. It has to be perfect because people will find the little mistake or the loophole and want you to explain it. And we took about a month break after what we call our trial run, which is when we first, after our training, we jumped in and thought that everyone else was going to be ready, and they weren't. So after our trial run, we took a break to write our clear description of the project, the survey process, and a detailed description of the survey ratings. Once we had our documentation ready, we began contacting institutions about the survey schedule, and we quickly learned that we were the only two archivists in Chicago who knew about the project. 2 years had passed between the time when initial discussions about the consortium and the potential for the survey project had taken place and when Burgess and I were hired. We also learned that just because the Dean of Libraries had become a member of the BMRC or had agreed to participate did not necessarily mean that the archivists knew that they were slated to participate. And people were naturally skeptical of a group of strangers coming to look at their material. Many were unsure of our qualifications. They'd never heard of us before. We were both new transplants to Chicago. And we were questioned so often that we began introducing ourselves not only by name, but our degrees and places of graduation. We worked very hard to build trust between us and the participants, and one of the most important steps that we took was setting up informational meetings to dispel some of the misconceptions about the project. It gave us an opportunity to introduce ourselves, explain the goals of the project, and start building a relationship. The meeting would consist of basically four elements. We would begin by ensuring participants that the BMRC does not collect material. We also don't act as a third-party broker for the private collections that we work with through the survey. We provide a clear demonstration of the database along with a description of the survey process and provide copies of all of our documentation for them to review at their own leisure. And we would also assure them that only approved collections would be made publicly available on the website. So at this point, you may be asking yourself, who in the world would agree to participate in this thing in the first place? We surveyed three broad categories of repositories: BMRC full member organizations, associate members, and second space members. Full members and associate members are made up of traditional repositories with trained archival staff. When serving at these repositories, we always reviewed processed and unprocessed collections. By surveying unprocessed collections, we could identify the content and determine if the perceived African-American research value was inherent. We would also assess preservation issues that may have developed since the initial accession of the collection. When surveying processed collections, the primary goal was to provide better access to collections that were not accurately described, were not believed to initially contain African-American history research value at all. And in order to create better access to these collections, we created more specific headings, subject and access headings. And we also checked for preservation issues that may have appeared since the collection was originally processed. One of the most important aspects of the survey was working with what we refer to as second space members. We worked with a wide range of second space participants from collections in people's homes, community and art organizations, cultural centers, and community archives. Our goal when working with second space was to identify what exists, what is out there that is not represented, assess the condition of the material, and assess the historical significance if it wasn't already known. I'd like to share one example of our experience working with second space. Burgess and I are pictured here working with the late photographer Eric Warner, who is a great friend and advocate of the BMRC. For 3 weeks, we worked in his basement looking through his material. And the most enjoyable part was having the opportunity to listen to him talk about his experiences. He had been shooting in Chicago for over 40 years, and his knowledge and documentation of Chicago cultural history was extremely helpful to us. And his collection is a perfect example of why it's so important for us to reach out to artists and community members. His body of work added so much more to the historical narrative. As you might expect, reaching out to second space proved a harder challenge than working with traditional repositories. And because we had to build these relationships from scratch, we worked very hard to communicate the benefits of the survey and how it could help them. And in trying to recruit and maintain our second space members, it was also important that we continued to build the relationship after we had completed the survey. We accomplished this by making sure that they had uninhibited access to us, the survey staff, the survey results, and BMRC-led workshops. We also made sure to emphasize the value of the collection regardless of the size or physical condition. While surveying second space collections was only the starting point, we think that in this small way, the BMRC has helped give a voice to non-traditional repositories by helping them realize the value of their collections and by taking steps to build trust between archival institutions and the African-American community in Chicago. In this picture here, Andy, a previous survey archivist, and I are helping Sherry Williams, the founder of the Bronzeville Historical Society, conduct emergency preservation by rehousing some of the material while we surveyed. In closing, I'd like to highlight the four goals achieved at the end of the project term in December 2011. The first is grants. In January 2011, the BMRC received a two-year clear hidden collections grant in order to process collections that were identified based on the ratings of the survey project. We are currently processing at, I think, 13 institutions and 115 collections around the city. Second space member, Bronzeville Historical Society, received a grant from the Illinois State Historical Records Advisory Board to purchase archival supplies. And second space member, Shorefront Legacy Center, received a grant for public programming. And their director, Dino, wanted me to share that participation in the consortium continues not only to help them in funding, but also boosting their presence to community decision makers. Internal analysis is harder for the BMRC to gauge since once the assessment is discontinued or finished, it's in the hands of the individual institutions, and we aren't a part of the internal process anymore. I do know from informal conversations I've had with our CLEAR participants through the visiting with them is that the surveys help them place processing priorities and gain a step up on their backlogs. And every collection, as I mentioned before, has a collection level description that was provided to the institution along with their survey assessment, and the descriptions were also used as access point for researchers on the survey website. In October 2011, we launched the web searchable interface for the survey database, and researchers are able to view collection information from survey records and link to repositories' website, online finding aids if they exist, and view and link to related collections, which is unheard of in Chicago. The website also provides researchers with one central location to view and explore Chicago's African American archival collections. And for those of you interested, we also have links to our ratings guide, project descriptions, and other documentation if you're interested in using them or learning more about the survey project. And to close, I'd like to share with you our final numbers because, one, I think it's impressive. We did a lot of work for a staff of three. And to also provide an opportunity to thank all of our participants for trusting us in the end and allowing us to poke through their material. We surveyed at 43 institutions or locations, looked at 1,139 collections for a total of over 35,000 linear feet. All right. Thank you.
Hi. I'm going to speak with you today about my experience engaging master's degree students in the School of Information at the University of Michigan in two consecutive projects surveying unprocessed collections of archival and manuscript material held by the Special Collections Library. Working in teams of two and three, using an assessment methodology modeled on similar efforts elsewhere, 55 students collected quantitative and qualitative information on a total of 40 unprocessed collections of archival and manuscript material. The Special Collections Library holds internationally renowned collections of books, manuscripts, and archival material. It's home to some of the most historically significant treasures at the University of Michigan and includes in its holdings some 275,000 published volumes, approximately 5,000 linear feet of archival material, about 450 incunables, and nearly 1,400 early manuscripts on vellum and paper. Notable collections and subject strengths include the history of astronomy and mathematics, children's literature, anarchism, radicalism, and social protest, Philippine history, transportation history, and visionary filmmakers including Orson Welles and Robert Altman. The University of Michigan School of Information is one of the first and one of the largest iSchools in the country. It combines traditional programs in library and information science with national strengths in archives and records management, preservation, health informatics, human-computer interaction, and social computing. The archives and records management program specialization is supported by four full-time faculty and eight doctoral students. Last May, the School of Information awarded 165 MSI degrees, 40 of which went to students specializing in archives and records management. Okay. I had two main reasons for wanting to conduct a survey of our unprocessed collections. to better understand the nature and the scope of our not insignificant hidden collections problem, and to test the feasibility of and estimate the resources required for a comprehensive survey of all collections held in the Special Collections Library, the purpose of which would be to make possible the creation of adequate and uniform collection level descriptions, establish and guide processing priorities, and inform pressing collection management decisions. I honestly can't remember whose idea it was, mine or Paul's, and I mean Paul Conway, instructor at the School of Information with whom I worked on the first class, and also my husband, to assign my survey project to the students in his Understanding Archives class. I think it emerged in one of the many really good conversations that we tend to have. Anyways, the advantages for all were immediately obvious. For the instructor, it provided a meaningful alternative to yet another research paper that the students would have to write and he would have to read. It also served as a manageable way to effectively integrate several of the most important topics of the class, including appraisal, description, and preservation. It was also manageable in that it was doable, largely because of what I was doing at my end, and gradable. Finally, it provided a welcome opportunity for a new collaboration, a partnership with another unit on campus as a complement to the partnership that already exists between the School of Information and the Bentley Historical Library. For the Special Collections Library, it was free labor. Actually, it wasn't really free, but it was the only way that I'd be able to get the project done. It was also an opportunity for us to consider new ways of working with School of Information students. And for the students, it met the need for practical, hands-on engagement with archival collections, and it meant one less paper to write. Okay, I'd like to speak for just a minute about some of the challenges I experienced getting this project up and running in the Special Collections Library. Getting buy-in from my then brand-new colleagues wasn't easy. Some were concerned about exposing our hidden collections problem. Why now? Others about exposing it to and by way of a bunch of students. Why them? Some were simply worried about the amount of work it would require. I'm too busy. And still others about logistical matters, such as what about security, scheduling, etc. Getting help from these same colleagues, once it was desired that we'd proceed with the project, was essential and invaluable. Identifying the collections that would or could or should be surveyed was also difficult. Many were considered to this or to that for the assessment project. In the end, we identified a first and then a second group of collections, 40 or so in total, that we'd be willing to expose for surveying. Not difficult, just a lot of work was developing and documenting the procedures that would guide and inform the survey project. Here I had a lot of help from my colleagues, one in particular, and relied very heavily on the growing body of widely shared project documentation from other efforts, most notably that of the Philadelphia Area Consortium of Special Collections Libraries. A number of the concerns expressed by my colleagues proved to be well-founded. We had to figure out how to schedule and oversee the students' work in a facility that is typically off-limits to everybody except us. We had some collection material go temporarily missing, boxes that weren't where we thought they should be or didn't seem to exist at all. The students got extra credit for locating these. We also had to provide some last-minute in-the-field guidance, including how to indicate collection material that was neither filed legal nor filed letter but just piled. So the instructor was committed to developing meaningful learning objectives for the assessment activity, which would count for 35% of the grade. Upon completion of the assignments, students should be able to appreciate the complexity and variety of archival collections, articulate criteria associated with assigning research value, identify and document conservation issues and preservation needs, assemble information needed for collection level description, and anticipate and explain processing challenges. The deliverables included an Excel workbook in which this data was collected and a written survey report, which provided an opportunity for the students to elaborate on the nature and the scope of the collections they assessed and to reflect on the survey experience itself. While the quality of the data gathering was uniformly high, the quality of the reports varied widely, based in part on the level of effort and time expended by the students. It was important for us to impart a level of confidence in students who were very much in a learning mode. We didn't provide any hands-on training. We did our best to assure them that we were just asking them to apply what they are learning in class. The fact that the assessment methodology, the survey tool, that they would be using had been used successfully by others was reassuring, as was the procedure manual that we provided. There were lots of questions, mostly having to do with the assignment itself. How many things are we supposed to hand in? When is this due? And we had to deal with the fact that this was a group project, and well, you know how those can go. In fact, for a couple of the collections, we got two assessments and two survey reports because the group members just couldn't or maybe didn't want to work together. Okay, so what we learned. I don't have anything to add to what's here on this slide. These are very much my takeaways from the assessment project. The only real surprise for me was how many of the collections could be made available with relatively little additional work, most of which, not surprisingly, would involve description. My colleagues, in some cases, weren't all that happy to learn, perhaps be told is more appropriate, that some of the collections that had been languishing in our backlogs have questionable research value or might even be considered out of scope. What we learned about those students, nothing to add here either. In general, the students were enthusiastic, engaged, and very thoughtful about everything they encountered and experienced doing this assignment. We'll go ahead and attribute that to the quality of the education they are receiving in the Archives program in the School of Information. So, what did they learn? Archival collections are interesting and complicated. The students were fascinated by much of the material, including personal correspondence and especially the realia. We seem to have a lot of that. Archival collections are acquired in a variety of contexts and for all kinds of reasons, some good and not so good, that aren't always immediately apparent, especially to those who are new to archives and special collections. They're not always apparent to the more seasoned among us either. The students learn that there's a lot going on when theory meets reality. One of the differences between the way I staffed my assessment project and others have staffed theirs is that my surveyors only got to look at one or two collections instead of several or even many. The students would have benefited from an opportunity to compare notes and, using information about all of the collections, participate in an exercise about setting processing, preservation, digitization, and other priorities. Okay, some words of wisdom. This slide pretty much speaks for itself. I've already shared some of the surprises. I haven't talked about some of the ways that we have and haven't followed through on what we did and what we learned. Borrow shamelessly. We've all done it, and you should too. Think creatively. No excuses. There are plenty of ways to get the job done. And act strategically. Here, and in conclusion, I'll draw from an article that Merrily and I are writing for the fall issue of RBM, a journal of rare books, manuscripts, and cultural heritage. Institutions have been assessing archival collections using a variety of methodologies for some time now. The combination of almost limitless collecting opportunities and increasingly limited resources, however, especially when coupled with increased attention on our hidden collections problem, the prospect of an avalanche of born digital materials coming into our repositories, and a new emphasis on measuring value, assessing impact, and data-driven decision-making means that a growing number of us are and should be more interested in archival collections assessment than ever. Fortunately, as I hope you have learned in this session, there are lots of well-developed, well-documented ways to do it, and a growing community of those of us who have done it. I invite you to the party. Thank you.
And thank you, Martha. Our panelists have done an amazing job of honing their presentations down to between 12 and 15 minutes each. And we did this was a goal that we developed for ourselves as a panel, to leave plenty of time for your questions. We wanted this to be a session where you could learn very practical things and ask us very practical questions in return. Since the session is being recorded, if you ask a question, I'll try to repeat it back and rephrase it so that it can be captured as part of the recording of this session. So I invite you to ask questions and share observations with our panelists. Yes? Okay, so the question is for Martha and Lisa, and it's about, in particular, when borrowing from the Paxgol methodology, how did you cope with the research rating, which I will add we recognize can be one of the most challenging components of these. Yeah. Right, so, yeah. Right. Include with that a brief description of what the research rating is.
I can go first. Yeah. Thank you. For the BMRC, we tailor the Paxgol database and rating surveys quite heavily to our own needs. So it started out with we rate based on housing, physical condition, intellectual access, physical access, and then the research value rating. We broke the research value rating into two parts so we could identify African-American research value and overall collection research value. Within each of those, there were two distinct parts of the research value, and it's been a while since I've worked on it. It was documentation quality and interest. So we would rate a collection based on how well the historical, event person was documented within that collection, and then what a perceived research interest would be. And those two elements together would make the total research value. 10 was the highest, 1 was the lowest.
And the only thing I can add to that is that the ratings that we all used are in the documentation, which is available on the various project websites. Like Lisa said, it's a combination of the interest of the documentation, how much information is in the collection on a particular topic, and then how good that information is. And there's two different ratings, 1 to 5. For each, but the language for making that assessment is in the project documentation. It's in the procedure manual that I developed, and I'm sure that folks use for their projects as well.
And all of Paxgol's documentation is still available on their website as well, if you want the original source.
Yes, in the back of the room.
Okay, I will repeat the question. Was how much in terms of linear feet material did the students work on, and then how many hours did they spend? I would say on average they spent about 8 hours as a group working with the collection, and I can't say about the linear. I mean, I have all of this information because they were, for the assignment, they were required to document the time that they spent, not just on all the different parts, but they were. They had to document the time they spent working with the collection material, learning the survey tool, writing their report, and everything like that. If you want to contact me, I'd be happy to provide you with more specifics.
Yes, Barb.
I'd like to, if anybody can answer.
Yeah. So, This provides me a perfect opportunity to talk about one of the members of the working group that helped to write the Taking Stock paper, Sarah Stouderman from the Smithsonian Archives. The Smithsonian Archives does manage a fairly comprehensive system that's not project-based. They've used it long-term, and it measures use of collections, level of description, level of processing, preservation and conservation needs, and it does have that temporal dimension so that they're able to do very impressive reports that show this range of collections had this preservation need and this action was taken, and the improvement is can be documented and then shown. So it's quite a good system. It's in, I think, Microsoft Access and not easily replicated, but they have done a pretty, you know, they have, Sarah is very approachable about, you know, being able to show screenshots and share documentation from their system.
One of the outcomes of our survey is that putting preservation into all phases of archival management. So we were really able to leverage using preservation staff, myself, to do field surveys of collections before they came in, to recommend, to sort of document what was coming in, to recommend stuff that shouldn't come in, or to isolate it if it was absolutely necessary to come in and in bad condition. So that pretty much gave a lot of heads up for preservation planning and for resource management overall through the archival, with archival repositories. That's in terms of what's coming in for condition. However, just to address your other question, when we started doing remediation projects, we would, the round trip of, once an action was taken on a collection, we were using Google Docs to share information about collections and export it from the database, give it to the archivists and their staff, and their graduate student staff. They change something about the collection, I would get that back, and then adjust the database. That was the only way we could do it at the time. I wish it was more automated. I could share the database with them. I could get the database to turn, green when the collection had been worked on, right? So we knew that what records were, what collections had been worked on and what had not. So that's just database maintenance, basically, at the end, down the road, for whoever's got the job next.
Is there anybody here from the Bancroft Library? Because I know that they have had ongoing a number of initiatives to survey collections. And first they did the unprocessed and underprocessed surveys, and then they went back and did everything so that they had the same information about everything. And I believe that they intend to continue documenting going forward, but without seeing any hands go up.
Can I just say there's a lot of what next was born digital, but three ideas that come to mind response to your question are: start asking donors about digital material, figure out a consistent way to document it when it comes in, and consider whether you even want physical media at all.
I saw another hand up. Yes. So the question is, with so many people using PacSchool and Son of PacSchool methodologies and tools, has anybody looked across institutions and groups who have used the same tool to see if there's any commonalities or anything? And I don't know. Barb? So the answer there is talk to Barb Akins at the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian is, I'm just repeating back for the Smithsonian is looking at ways to measure across various units, and it looks like is perhaps having some success with. Yeah. Right. Other questions for panelists? Right, so the comment is going back to the AT Archon roundtable yesterday, and so as background, the Archivist Toolkit does have an assessment module in it that was drawn from the PacSchool methodology. In fact, I think it's exactly the PacSchool tool built embedded in AT, but that's not being carried forward into archive space, and so the question was, how can the community respond to that? And there was actually a pretty good discussion at the roundtable yesterday and afterwards where we were asked to provide some use cases, because that's how archive space development is going to be going forward. And Martha and I both agreed to supply a number of such use cases to the roundtable, I think.
Yeah, There was a follow-up conversation at that meeting yesterday, and the way that it was kind of described to us or explained to us is just what Marilee said. They call them user stories, and so we would effectively just, if we can kind of document what we need in the forum of what we want to do and what kind of tools and boxes and fields and stuff we need to be able to put in an assessment record into archive space. That's the way that it would get on in the development queue or on the agenda. And this, I guess, it could come from anybody. It could come from the round table, or it could come from folks who just want to do the work to make sure that an assessment module does get added to archive space.
But they did very much cast this as user stories. So not just I need to assess collections, but I have a need to assess my backlog in order to prioritize for processing, or I have an opportunity to apply for preservation funds in this area. How do I best do that? So that the user story should be articulated like that, not just, well, I need collections assessment. And you had something to add, Jennifer?
We started looking, of course, at assessment on acquisition. So we developed and it didn't get implemented before I left the job, but it looked really promising, a Google form for archivists to input data. And it's something like I built and vetted through Preservation Administration and other archivists as well. So it had a lot of the assessment information from the toolkit, but we didn't want to put in the toolkit because we didn't know how it was going to come out later and migrate into archive space. So Google Docs, Google Forms will then input into a spreadsheet. It's in a Google spreadsheet, which is actually a pretty safe form for it to be in until you want to put it somewhere else. So, and the form can live online and it's accessible to anyone. You can control the spreadsheet yourself if you don't want anyone else to touch that either.
How many of you were considering doing some sort of collections assessment, either having to do with processing or backlogs or digitization or preservation? Wow, so lots of you. So what are you doing here? No, I'm just kidding. I mean, why aren't you doing it right now? There's all weekend, right? Okay. Other pressing questions for our panelists? Yes, back there.
Oh, right. Repeat the question. The question is, I talked about using the analog to inform the digital, and were we able to do any assessment of how they overlap, essentially? That slide was an attempt at a punt. But no, I didn't. There's many reasons for that. It was a 265 cubic foot analog collection, and I'm afraid that the overlap just was in the digital part, so the 100 gigabytes of data was probably significant enough to keep us busy before we ever got to the analog. And inertia, getting jobs, that sort of thing. So, I never got to that point. I think that could be a challenge, though, obviously, especially because, you know, obviously a 265 box collection, we're not looking at every page in that. However, like I think I indicated, there were ways to sort of map the processing of the analog material to the digital material, and there might have been, you know, ways to make connections there at a macro level, but I don't know how precise that would have been.
Other questions lurking out there? Well, I'm not seeing any hands, but I was just amazed to see so many hands go up, so many people. Martha and I have been asserting that there is a growing community of people taking on collections assessment, and I'm so happy that so many of you are thinking about doing that and that so many of you came to this session today. So please help me in joining in thanking the panel in the usual way. And please remember speaking of assessment, please remember to do the conference evaluation form and enjoy the rest of your conference.